The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. It's a year since Theresa May pitted her strong and stable leadership against the absolute boy, Jeremy Corbyn. We hear from spinners and MPs about their memories of that long election night. And we discuss how the political landscape has changed and how it hasn't in the 12 months since. Also this week, the RMT calls for Chris Grayling to resign and Northern and GTR could be barred from rail franchises as a disastrous timetable change leaves thousands of passengers facing cancellations and delays. Who should take the blame and what happens next? But first, happy anniversary. The Guardian's Jessica Elgott takes us back to June the 8th, 2017 and the night of the general election.
For many MPs and party spinners, election nights are some of the most stressful of their lives. They have a nail-biting 24 hours, squinting then at piles of votes to try and see if one pile maybe looks that little bit bigger in a drafty sports hall. And then they snatch sleeping cars on the way to TV studios to get shouted at. And then at the end of it all, if they're lucky, they have to go straight back to work at Westminster. So I've talked to some MPs and some ex-spinners from all the parties about that roller coaster night a year ago.
Hello, I'm Paul Butters. I used to be Tim Farron's spin doctor and now I work for Best for Britain. So I ran a committee room on election day. So I was up at 4 a.m. That was exciting, delivering leaflets at 4 a.m. to Tim Farron's constituency in sunny Cumbria. And the worst thing in the world, if anyone who ever does elections will tell you, is that you have to be careful of the lights that go on automatically and the dogs. Because literally, there's no one will vote for you if you set the dog off at 4 a.m. You have to literally just walk up to people's like letterboxes at 4 a.m. and not make noises, looking like a robber.
I'm Ben Bradley, the Member of Parliament for Mansfield.
Your seat was one that really bucked the trend, and so it went from Labour to Conservative. And what kind of things were people saying to you on the day? Were they making their decision on the day?
I don't think so. I mean, a lot of people changed their mind from previously. But throughout the whole campaign, we'd heard, you know, I've always been Labour. My granddad worked down the pit, he'd turn in his grave and all the rest of it. But I'll never vote for Jeremy Corbyn, or I never saw the last guy for 30 years. Or I want Brexit. It was one of those three things for pretty much everybody we spoke to.
I have to be honest and say that that day we thought Tim might lose his seat. Obviously, most campaigns will have all the data. You sit there about 2 weeks before going, we're in a lot of trouble here. So you had to go until 10 o'clock. We prepared Tim and said, you know, have you thought about what you might want to do next in life? And, you know, we think we might win some seats, but you might not be one.
Paul Ovenden, former Labour press officer. As the exit poll came up on the screen, there's this 1 or 2 seconds where people are taking it in. And then I remember a few kind of cries of yes and some jubilation and a lot of people just trying to process it. The best comparison I think I could give is it felt a little bit like, say you're watching a football match and your team are big underdogs and they go 1-0 up in the first minute. There's that real excitement, but then there's also this feeling of, you know, we've got to hold this lead because people have been burnt by exit polls before. But certainly, I'll never forget that rush of emotion and excitement.
What was it like as the night went on? Did people start thinking practically that, you know, Labour might get into government?
There was certainly a point, I would say, 1-2 in the morning, where it felt to me like we might win this. You'll remember that, you know, the Sunderland result came in, which actually made it look like the exit poll had overstated Labour. Within an hour and a half or so, there was a result came in from Swindon, which looked like it had understated Labour. So you're constantly balancing those competing results that are coming in.
My name's Tom Swarbrick. I'm a former advisor to Theresa May in Number 10 and got into the building about August 2016, just after Brexit. 10 o'clock hit. Dimbleby said those famous words about, no, they don't yet have a majority. And there was just total silence from about 100 plus people in the room. Nobody moved. Nobody said anything. The only sound was somebody retching. I still don't know who it was who was retching. But that was the only sound. And it remained that way for what felt like forever, but must have been about 5 minutes.
Was there any kind of denial at first that it could be right, or did it kind of confirm something deep down that people might have had a bit of a suspicion about at the end of the campaign?
I think it was the worst possible scenario that we'd all been hoping wouldn't happen. No one expected it to be a hung parliament. When it first dropped, the exit polls aren't always 100% accurate, so there was a feeling, okay, well, let's see the first results come in. And I think in Newcastle and Sunderland, the swing wasn't enough to make it look like the exit poll was accurate. So there was a glimmer of hope at that point.
Tulip Sadiq, I'm the MP for Hampstead and Kilburn. So in 2017, which was last year, everyone told me I was going to lose. The Evening Standard did a huge splash on me and my opponent talking about how she looked so confident she was going to be the next MP. So everyone I spoke to just complained and complained about the Labour Party, talked about issues of anti-Semitism, brought up lots of different things that they were unhappy with. And I just thought about how was I going to find another job after having been an MP, I'm going to have to start looking in the job market. And then I went home in a similar vein, turned on the television. I was thinking, I don't believe the exit polls. And then suddenly, I got a call from my campaign manager, who is usually very negative. And he just called me and said, you might want to come early. I think you're going to enjoy this. And so it was very cryptic, but I got to the count a bit earlier than I normally would. So normally I don't go till 2 a.m. or so, because you don't get the results till 7 a.m. Decided to go around midnight. To be honest, I just couldn't believe it. The stacks were getting higher and higher with my name on it, and it's the result I expected in 2015, which I didn't get. So it was quite a night to remember.
Tell us, what's the majority that you got? What did it go from and to?
It was 1,000 in 2015. It's now 15,500. And I went into a snap election campaign 6 weeks thinking I had to find another job.
There was a moment around 10:30, 11 o'clock when Nick Clegg kind of sashayed onto ITV and went, I think we're in a bit of trouble here. And then your phone goes absolutely mental for everybody going, what's going on? And you're like, yeah, he's in a lot of trouble. And then you get a flurry of texts from your HQ going, don't say anything. Don't say anything. So you're like, okay. Oh, it's early days. It's early days. It's literally the response I think every press officer will ever send about that time of the night.
We were on the 8th floor of Labour HQ, where it was a very sober affair. Come sort of 9:10 in the morning, when the results are in, there's a realisation that the country has voted for something quite different to what people anticipated, and that the work wasn't over. So you've had this 7-week campaign, you sort of think that at the end of it you might get a bit of rest, but it was quite apparent to us that wasn't going to happen. It was going to be ongoing. We were going to have to carry on holding the government's feet to the fire.
There was a moment during the night when the first Conservative MPs who had been re-elected started to slam the campaign.
When you look back now, a year later, could things have been handled better on the day? Do you think that actually everyone pulled together? What's your kind of long view of it?
I'd always wanted to work on a political campaign. I'd never worked on a political campaign before, but I've been a reporter, so you follow this stuff quite closely. The camaraderie was amazing. You know, I've made friends there that will be friends for the rest of my life, that we went through this something that was so utterly extraordinary and so difficult and hard. My God, it was hard work. But you build a real, real team spirit there. And it is immensely sad for those people who have worked on it and spent an awful lot of time and really want it to do well when it doesn't go well and it hasn't gone well. There are people who's lost their jobs that night, who worked incredibly hard.
In the days afterwards, George Osborne, remember him, described Theresa May as a dead woman walking, but fade to 12 months later and she's still in Downing Street with a little help from her friends in the DUP. Joining me to discuss what difference a year makes are Jill Rutter, Programme Director at the Institute for Government, Ryan Shorthouse from the Conservative think tank Bright Blue, and on the line, The Guardian's Gabby Hintzliff. Ryan, the Conservatives went into that campaign with a double-digit lead in the polls and came out of it without a parliamentary majority. It's not an anniversary the Prime Minister will want to dwell on, is it?
Well, you know, she's still there. A lot of people thought that she had to go very quickly because her authority was drained.
Including you, I think, at the time. Am I right in saying?
Yeah, we thought actually it would be the right thing to do for her to step down and allow a successor to come in as soon as possible. But she's still there. And frankly, the threat from the Labour Party, as we've seen in the local election results in May, is still not big enough. There is still, I think, a ceiling, I think, associated with Corbyn's leadership, which means the threat to Theresa May is still not strong enough from the Labour Party to warrant any substantial change. And then on top of that, I think really there isn't anybody naturally obvious in the Conservative Party to take over from Theresa May, particularly at quite a delicate time. So, yes, she has been damaged politically by that last election. She has actually changed some bits of her policy programme. Gone is the whole post-liberal agenda, which was sort of very sceptical of things like human rights, citizens of the world. There's actually a bit more of an outreach to younger people in her programme. So Michael Gove's got very big on the environment. Bright Blue did some polling last year, which showed that actually the biggest concern for 28 years and younger people was the environment, and wanted politicians to talk about it more. So there has been a slight shift in focus away from that post-liberal agenda to something a little bit more broader, which includes the environment. But has there been kind of radical change since then? I don't think so.
Part of that change that we have seen that Ryan talked about is about Labour being able to shift some of the debate onto its own territory, isn't it? There was this sort of phrase that went round among Corbyn's supporters after the general election, Jeremy Corbyn is the Prime Minister, which of course he isn't. But some of those issues...
Some people still seem to struggle with that idea.
They do. But also anti-austerity in some of these things that we're talking a little bit more about than we were before, the agenda's changed a bit, hasn't it?
I think something really interesting has happened, which is that, I mean, it's not just that Jeremy Corbyn feels obviously safer, more secure, more confident in himself. I mean, you remember during the election, you know, there was almost a sense of, you know, when's the leadership contest going to start? People could barely wait until the polls had closed to get on with the business of deposing Jeremy Corbyn. And then suddenly it was like, oh, OK, that's not going to happen. You know, complete of our base. So his sort of growing confidence has just helped transform Labour's fortunes to a certain extent. But there is absolutely the sense that the Tories recognise where they failed. They recognise they failed among, we always say younger voters, but that means people under 42 is where they failed. It depends on your definition of young. And are taking steps to try and address that, which means they are naturally moving onto some of Labour's territory. So they're suddenly talking about spending more on the NHS. That might be happening at this time in the electoral cycle anyway, because we can see that the NHS is struggling. But I think it's very much driven by the sense of Labour snapping at their heels. They're making noises yet again about housing and, you know, enabling more young people to buy houses. They talked about reviewing or thinking again on tuition fees. You know, I don't think all of these things would be as far up the agenda as they are if it wasn't for the fact that, A, Labour's pushing them, and more importantly, the people that voted Labour have pushed those things up the agenda.
Mm, and Tory backbenchers, sometimes you felt they didn't have a good answer to some of those things out on the campaign trail, I think. Jill, it's one thing to change the debate and the conversation, but this is a government that's operating in a hung parliament, isn't it? What does that mean for the sort of day-to-day running of government and what Theresa May can do and can't?
Well, I think it's a general instruction that's gone out across Whitehall and to ministers, which is whatever you want to do, please try and do it without legislation. And what we saw is, actually, intriguingly, the government has passed quite a lot of bills, which I was surprised when one of my colleagues was preparing a new IFG publication called Parliamentary Monitor, dug out that actually, you know, quite a lot of bills have been passed. The government's introduced 32 bills, and it's actually got royal assent to 19 of them. Quite a few of those are sort of financy bill stuff or estimates. Others are Northern Ireland emergency legislation, because obviously one of the things the government's had to do is take back control of Northern Ireland because of the absence of an executive there. But then, actually, it's really weird, the sort of legislation that's coming forward. Because, of course, one of the early things that the Prime Minister had to do as part of her deal with the DUP was ditch some of the sort of more toxic, less popular bits of the manifesto, those sort of things around social care, triple lock on pensions that we might have expected, or indeed grammar schools might have expected to see a big part of a new legislative programme. And instead, frankly, apart from the Brexit bills, the other ones look like the sort of bills that basic departments store up for the last term of a parliamentary session when the government's really run out of ideas. They're sort of useful housekeeping, not that much more than that, or the ones that they hand out to the sort of people who luck out in the ballot and don't have any ideas in the private members' ballot of what they want to introduce themselves. So it's a very weird set of sort of second, third order legislation that is taking up bits of parliamentary time. So it's been very weird. I think one of the really interesting things about the last year, and something that we forget in times when we have governments with a strong majority, is that Parliament's mattered enormously over the last year. There's a lot of action going on in Parliament, both on the floor of the House, when the government turns up for votes and things like that, but also in the committee room as well. There's a lot of action going on in Parliament, which is one of the interesting consequences of having a minority government.
Gabby, that's partly because Labour has particular tactics about how it's using the hung parliament to pursue its agenda. It's also partly because we have divided parties, don't we, on both sides. Mm. And so we have sort of very talented MPs on the backbenches who are making names for themselves as select committee chairs and so on, and exerting their power in that way.
Yes, select committee chair jobs used to be the sort of thing that you did either at the end of a long and distinguished career and brought all your gravitas to bear on them, or the sort of, for very independent-minded MPs who didn't want to go up the ministerial ladder. And now it's become, you know, it's what Yvette Cooper does with her days. She's not on front bench. And so you have these quite high-powered select committees. But at the same time, a lot of MPs complaining of not really having enough to do. You know, why isn't the government putting more legislation through the House? Why are they sort of being left twiddling their fingers to a certain extent and then suddenly trying to rush through, you know, all the bits of the withdrawal bill that the Lords sent back in 12 hours, in 12 hours, and then they're sort of sitting vacant for the rest of the day. So there's a sense there's been a bit of a zombie feel to Parliament for a while.
Is that right, Ryan? Is that something you hear from Conservatives where they'd like to see a bit more going on? And partly it's just because Brexit's such a big issue and it's using up such a lot of time, isn't it?
Yeah, actually, I would say that because it's a minority government, you have got a lot of backbench power. So, you know, we've seen some amendments come forward. Stella Creasy in the Queen's speech last year, for example, got the free abortions on NHS England for people coming from Northern Ireland. Bob Blackman had his homelessness reduction bill put into law. Remember the organ donation opt-out bill as well from a Labour backbench. So, you know, we are seeing Parliament assert itself, not only through these amendments and private members' bills, but also, as Gabby says, through powerful select committee chairs. And you're finding some very interesting alliances emerging, particularly on Brexit. A lot of centre ground, as they define themselves, both Labourites and Tories, looking for a, you know, membership of the customs union and single market. So you're finding those interesting alliances. I think a lot of Conservative MPs, like I say, just feel that the threat from Corbyn is not quite strong enough to warrant taking action on Theresa May. I think Theresa May is somebody who really interestingly has nobody who she has close, there's no close allies of Theresa May, but equally
not a sort of camp of followers.
No, yeah. But equally there's no real enemies. In fact, she's got where she has, I think, by not being too close or too antagonistic with anybody. And so when the going gets tough, then you don't have those allies to really sort of champion your agenda. But what I think is, from the local election results, you can see there's a ceiling to Corbyn's support. There's scepticism out there for a kind of Corbyn left-wing agenda. And I think that makes Conservative MPs less kind of anxious and less motivated to take action against the Prime Minister now.
And ultimately, it would be that. It would be the electoral imperative, would it, you think, that would force them, that would make them say, she's got to go?
I think that's right, yeah.
I think they've gone wise to be too complacent about that, to be honest.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, Gabby. That was the phrase "peak Corbyn" was used, I think, by some of the Tories after the local elections results. It was a kind of deadlock, as far as one could tell from those results, wasn't it?
It was, and you see something similar in the polls, and you see something similar when people are asked about their preferred prime minister. You know, and don't know is practically scooping the jackpot. But I think there are two sort of theories about what's happening here. One theory is that, you know, the reason that there hasn't been this sort of great polling breakthrough that perhaps people expected after the election, when people realised Jeremy Corbyn could win and all the rest of it, you know, maybe that really does mean that that was the high watermark, that they can't get a single vote more, and the reason they weren't breaking through in the Swindons and the Nuneatons and so on in the local elections is that they haven't done the work, that they haven't really looked at where they didn't get votes, where they failed to tip people over, just people who were sort of hesitating on the edge of voting Labour and hung back. They haven't really done the work to get those people to cross the line, which I think is a reasonable criticism. But the other theory is that actually, you know, politics isn't like it used to be, and midterm polling doesn't matter as much as you think, and that maybe, like last time, there'll be a sort of surge at the last minute during a campaign when, and things will change. There's a lot of people who don't pay attention to parties between elections, blah, 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 blah. I think the truth is somewhere in the middle of that. I don't think Labour has done enough work to convert people who weren't sure last time. But I do think the one lesson I've learned in the last year is, God's sake, don't predict anything. don't
assume that,
Gabby. You know where public opinion is at any given time, because public opinion is a lot more mobile and a lot more volatile than we ever used to think it was. And I just think for Tory MPs to work on the assumption there are so many seats that are just hanging by a thread and it's a few hundred votes would tip them over to Labour, it really doesn't take much of a shift before, you know, quite a lot of seats start falling. If I was a Tory MP, the last thing I would be is complacent.
Ryan?
Well, I think what Theresa May's government needs to be careful of and actually learn the lessons from the 2017 campaign is that becoming Corbyn light is the answer, that suddenly all these young people who, you know, thank goodness are classified as under 40, you know, all these young people are suddenly kind of craving a socialistic government. Actually, if you look at a lot of social attitude survey, there's strong kind of belief in personal responsibility, not kind of huge enthusiasm for state welfare. Actually, what I think the Tories need to be doing more is talking about and kind of reflecting a more socially liberal attitude amongst young people. And Cameron, I think, managed to get that majority in 2015 because the Tories were able to represent to some degree both social justice and social liberalism. Theresa May, with the whole burning injustice agenda, has gone very strong on social justice, but she's kind of ignored the social liberalism thing. And I think that's jarred with a lot of younger people. And also, I think the other thing is the Brexit vote as well. I think, you know, at the end of the day, the Prime Minister talks about the country to come coming together, but Westminster still being divided on Brexit. I don't actually think that's true. And I think the voting in the local election shows that actually there's been a drift to the two-party system again, because support over Brexit is still very divided in the country. And rightly or wrongly, Labour's seen as offering a more softer version, and the Tories are seen as offering a harder version. So I think a lot of people under 40 are very concerned about the direction of travel on Brexit. And that was much more influential on why they turned their backs on the Tories in the 2017 election, rather than a kind of appetite for a nationalising socialistic government from Corbyn.
Well, and not only is Theresa May not terribly hot on the socially liberal end of things, the Tories are also in an alliance with the DUP who have values that are quite the reverse of that on a number of issues. For example, as we saw rehearsed this week over abortion, does that not help?
I think that's part of the mix. But, you know, Theresa May has traditionally been very hardline on things like immigration, human rights. Remember that speech where she was critical of citizens of the world? That kind of jars with a cosmopolitan, liberal, modern outlook, which I think a lot of people who are under the age of 40 have. And I think, you know, the problem the Tories have is much more of a cultural problem rather than loads of younger people abandoning the kind of economic capitalist system or being sceptical of it. I think the problem is cultural, not economic, for the Tories.
Make space this weekend. Space for films about Chilean romance, plays about millennial angst, and poetry that makes you want to write poetry. Those new jackfruit superfood samosas, or not. A writer that's never been written about. The manager you might love, and opinions you might not. It's your weekend. Make space to be inspired. Pick up The Guardian and The Observer this weekend.
Jill's got a piece of paper for our listeners at home in front of her, which shows how the government's getting on, or rather not getting on, with Brexit. There's a hung parliament, which doesn't help, but this is the big overriding job that the government, that the state has got to do right now, isn't it, Jill? How's it getting on?
Well, I have to say, you can't say it's going swimmingly, can you, really? I mean, there are three huge big tasks on Brexit. We have got a report coming out really quite soon, which is looking at how ready is Whitehall for Brexit. If you look at the big tasks are negotiating Brexit. We still don't, and we're hearing today that the white paper that we were thinking of, the 155-page white paper, will be delayed till after the June Council. So we still don't really know in very granular detail what the government's, you know, opening ask is on the economic partnership that, after all, it was pressurising the EU to start negotiating this time last year, straight after the election. That was the David Davis bid, that we didn't want to get tied up in all these phase one issues. We wanted to actually get straight stuck in. We still don't know what the government's sort of detailed ask is. We've got some details in Mansion House. So we've got all that negotiating to do. We've still got the withdrawal agreement with big outstanding issues on both Ireland and who oversees the governance of the withdrawal agreement that aren't agreed, that need to be agreed before we're guaranteed a transition. So that's still in play. We then have got the legislation. The government sort of promised an initial 8 Brexit bills. So far, one has got royal assent. On sanctions and anti-money laundering. Another sort of 5 are still there. We've got the EU withdrawal bill coming back from the Lords next week. We've got the taxation cross-border trade bill and the trade bill, which are the sort of 2 new customs and trade policy bills, which have gone sort of missing in action since last January when they passed their committee stage in the Commons, but nobody seems to be scheduling report stage on those because they got some quite difficult amendments from Tory backbenchers. So that's quite interesting. Other ones, we've not even seen a white paper yet. The migration white paper was promised for last summer. It was published for the autumn. We all know the Whitehall Westminster autumn lasts until December. Haven't seen it. Yo, it's now somewhere. Presumably in Sajid Javid's in tray. The fisheries white paper, very controversial, even though fisheries is a minute proportion of GDP, says loads of really quite difficult things. And then the government's committed to introduce a sort of separate big piece of legislation once it's got its withdrawal agreement, which is the so-called WABE, the Withdrawal Agreement and Implementation Bill. And then you've still got implementation to happen. And we've been hearing some sort of slightly scary numbers from our good friends at HM Revenue and Customs. We've had the Armageddon scenarios being planned for contingency planning for what happens if we leave with no deal. But Whitehall basically is still trying to juggle how do you implement when you don't know the timeline and you don't know what you're implementing. And those are quite big, difficult things. So I think you'd have to say, if you were sort of doing a progress report on where might you hope to be 9-10 months away from our formal exit, I don't think you'd really want to be here.
And how talk to Whitehall civil servants a lot. How nervous are people, and how likely is it, do you think, that we could end up with some sort of, you know, legislative sort of train wreck that means that we're not ready?
I think it's quite interesting. On the legislation, I think what you would assume, and I'm sure what Whitehall will assume, is at the end of the day, if the prospect is Parliament sitting all night, all day for a very compressed session, people like you, Heather, getting no sleep for most of February, February and March, some sort of legislation will be in place. So I think probably the necessary legislation, if the alternative is that we have a big legal gap when we leave, then I think the legislation is probably in some ways the least of the problems, that you would do that. The implementation, there are things we can do unilaterally, and Chris Grayling, I think, has been talking a bit about, well, we wouldn't bother with controls, we wouldn't do that. That doesn't mean we avoid supply chain disruption, and the EU's actually been much more explicit than we have. I think only this week the Dutch are being reported to, as putting out warnings to some of their companies saying, if you depend on UK for some of your supply chain, you might want to think about not depending on the UK after Brexit. It's not clear how easy it will be to get things over the channel. And a lot of those Southeast Northern European supply chains are really optimised to just in time, which depends on absolutely no holdups between Dover and Calais as you row back and forth. So I think that's really interesting. Very interestingly, there's much more advice to business about what they might expect coming out of the EU Commission and other governments than there is anything from our government. And one of the things, and this is just a quick trailer for a bit of our report, one of our big things is actually because the cabinet is so split, and we haven't really talked about how much is, you know, being debated within cabinet, because the cabinet is so split, everything is being done under conditions of huge secrecy, really driven by domestic politics. But that all makes his planning and communication outwards infinitely more difficult than actually it need be if you weren't doing that. Because the truth is, we're not hiding anything really much from our European counterparts. We're just actually trying not to put things on the record for domestic political reasons.
Gabby, that's right, isn't it? There's this deadlock in cabinet, and there are these sort of warring camps within cabinet who then have their sort of followers out on the back benches, and you know, any policy declaration is sort of read through that lens.
Yes, and it was really very obvious actually in this week's Prime Minister's questions, when basically Jeremy Corbyn knocked Theresa May all over the park just by asking her a series of very simple questions that she should have been able to answer. You know, when is your Brexit white paper due, and so on and so on, and it showed that she couldn't answer anything, really, because there are no agreed answers for really quite sort of pivotal things. So, you know, there is a sort of public sort of stonewalling because there is no agreed line that you could say wouldn't upset somebody. Although it's fair to say that something rather similar is true on the Labour side. It's odd that both parties are deeply divided, disunited. There doesn't seem to be a sort of a Brexit around which the Conservative Party can all happily unite. There doesn't seem to be a Brexit around which the Labour Party can all happily unite. There is possibly a kind of Brexit on which Parliament could form a consensus, but that would require cross-party alliances all over the shop, And that is something that no one seems quite willing to contemplate.
And both parties seem to be governing their position at the moment, partly on the basis of party management, don't they? Rather than, although that's, I suppose, more worrying if you're actually in government and doing the negotiations.
Party management and electoral advantage. That's the other thing, because one of the reasons Labour is so divided is because of a sort of tug of war between Labour and Peace from different constituencies. I mean, if you represent a London constituency where people very strongly voted Remain, are appalled that the Labour Party would consider aiding and abetting Brexit, or even hesitating maybe about voting Labour for that reason, you know, then you have a very different take on what sort of Brexit the Labour Party should adopt than if you represent, you know, Don Valley or somewhere in the Welsh Valleys or a part of the UK that voted very heavily to leave. And in some of those seats where there was no great love for Jeremy Corbyn before, Brexit is the only reason the party is still sort of on speaking terms with them almost. And if it were to give that up and turn it, or to adopt a form of Brexit that, for example, didn't meant free movement can continue, obviously immigration was a big issue in those seats, then, you know, all bets are off. So it isn't just about party management, it's about electorates with one eye on the next election. And these sort of, you have a big tension between what people think might be right for the country, what might be right for the party, what might be right for narrow electoral advantage.
And Ryan, on the Tory side, there are those, aren't there, for whom Brexit is a kind of overriding issue, you know, that who've spent decades fighting for it. You know, how much of a risk do you think there is that the Tories end up splitting or dividing, or the government falling apart on this issue? Or do you think ultimately there is some sort of compromise to be found?
Well, I mean, I was in favour of the EU referendum in 2016, but I think it has opened up something which has become deeply divisive in the public.
It was meant to make it go away, wasn't it?
It was meant to make it go away, and that was sort of Cameron's intention, that the issue could be buried, and frankly, the Eurosceptics, who were very fixated on getting us out, could be, you know, this isn't a priority for the public. But, you know, political parties and the public at large are still very divided on it. It's taken the kind of role of a sort of cultural war issue, where a lot of the nuance and the grey in the middle is missed out because there are two sides going at each other. And every debate that we have, for example, cabinet is divided over whether we have a customs partnership or a Max-Fac partnership. And really, it's almost like a proxy between the old Remainers and the old Brexiteers, which shows you just how strong it is. One thing I would say is that the Prime Minister, there's a common trend to the Prime Minister, which is that the reality of what she does not match the rhetoric. And you've seen that with burning injustices. We've had a few good things like the domestic violence bill and the homelessness reduction bill. But actually, overall, there hasn't been big movement, despite that quite groundbreaking big speech that she made. And I'm afraid also with this whole EU negotiation, she has managed so far to keep the party together on the basis of rhetoric. And unfortunately, we're coming to a stage now where she has to choose a way forward on how we deal with customs.
Keep hearing that from both sides of the argument. That's what both sides are saying at the
moment. She's going to have to choose. She cannot just rely on rhetoric anymore. And this will be a testing point for her. I mean, my view is that actually the Prime Minister from the beginning laid out the starting position, the negotiation position with the EU, which was a hard Brexit position, which didn't really reflect the narrowness of the result. If she'd started with something like, we're going to try and keep in the single market or the customs union if we have greater control of migration. If we can't do that, then that's fine. But if that was the starting position, I think that would have reflected the narrowness of the result and got rid of this, frankly, huge opportunity cost the government now faces through years of very complicated Brexit negotiations.
That would, of course, have her voting for the Jeremy Corbyn amendment next week, which
That sounds like rather like where Labour's ended up, or perhaps it's still on the move, who knows. Jill, how much does it not help those sort of entrenched divisions that we've got with the different camps in government, that one of the things she did was to change the machinery of government, wasn't it, and set up these two new departments, which is quite a major thing to do. David Cameron didn't do very much of it, but, you know, we've got a Department for International Trade and we've got DexEU, which is all about delivering Brexit, but we've still got the Treasury and we've still got the Department for Business, and all of which have their own.
Well, what's really interesting is there was quite significant change. There have actually been sort of two machinery of government changes. The first one, she did something, we said don't do it, but she did, of setting up a dedicated, exiting the EU department. But then last September, there was this change when Ollie Robbins went from being David Davis's permanent secretary and chief negotiator and Prime Minister's Europe advisor. That was one job too many of those three. So he stopped being David Davis's permanent secretary and came back into the Cabinet Office. So actually, in terms of negotiations, certainly the negotiations now being driven very clearly from the Cabinet Office rather than Dixie EU. A lot of the heavy lifting is done in the Department for Exiting the EU, but the sort of, you know, the dominant mind, people actually say the sole mind on this is very much the sort of Ollie Robbins-Theresa May partnership there in on that. One of the things that's really interesting, I think deeply intriguing, at the Department of International Trade, which in a sense is a sort of not really a Brexit department. It's a sort of after-Brexit department because its big agenda kicks in when we're freed of the customs union. So one of the really interesting things is its incentives are very strange because actually we set up the Department for International Trade. We've told them you're the place that's going to develop trade expertise, but you don't get to negotiate the big trade relationship, which is, after all, the deal with the EU.
The biggest one, yeah.
And actually, we put, you know, one of the arch-Brexiteers in charge, Liam Fox, and actually, in a sense, the closer we align to our big trading block, the less scope you've got for everything else. And that's a really odd incentive set to give your international trade department, I think. So that's, I think, quite weird. I think the really interesting things about does the machinery of government change after Brexit? There's already some thoughts about when does DexEU disappear and a bit of a Whitehall turf war opening up over the entrails of DexEU. Foreign Office saying, oh, well, we should do that. It's about foreigners. That's us. You know, Foreign Office, I think, feeling deeply marginalised at the moment through the Brexit process. The Treasury saying, well, actually, a lot of that will be us. And actually, trade policy, that's about tariff. They're taxed. That's us. That's not Department for International Trade. That's another sort of interesting battle to come. I think undoubtedly there'll be a much bigger sort of operation in the Cabinet Office to support it. At the moment, you know, it's quite small. I think that will expand once DexEU goes. And that's really bound up with, you know, is there another Secretary of State for Exiting the EU once David Davis decides that he's done with this? Maybe when his old sparring partner Michel Barnier decides to sort of go and seek pastors new next summer. So I think it's a really interesting dynamic going on there. And, of course, the other thing that the Prime Minister did was put the three sort of Brexiteers in charge of those three big departments, the Foreign Office, DexEU and DIT. Though, actually, the truth was that on something as big as this, the Prime Minister was always going to be the person really running the negotiations. So I think it's quite interesting to see how it goes up, but, you know, quite difficult. The Treasury is, after the election, one of the big changes that we haven't mentioned was the relative knocking back of the Prime Minister, the loss of her advisers, a diminution in number 10 control, and the Treasury re-emerging as a bit of a force. The Treasury had been very, very marginalised up until the June election and suddenly came back with a vengeance. And we had actually those scenes through last summer of a lot of the Brexit debate happening in public, I think, while the Prime Minister was walking in Switzerland, between Philip Hammond, Liam Fox, David Davis, and things like that.
So it's a bit unseemly, isn't it?
One of the most interesting things is, you know, this government is at one level trying to be extremely secretive, but having huge numbers of really important political debates in full public glare, which I think, yeah, it was a time then where you were reading competing articles and seeing who was writing an article with whom next, which was quite fascinating to watch.
Yeah, and there's a bit of that, isn't there, Ryan, that collective responsibility is not as firm as it sometimes is, or perhaps as it ought to be. I mean, there's quite a lot, isn't there, of, you know, well-briefed interventions by, you know, Boris Johnson's calling for more NHS funding. And, you know, there is a bit of a sense that it's not a government that's functioning normally, isn't there?
I think that's right. And as I said, when Theresa May didn't win the majority that she sought in the 2017 election, her authority did drain somewhat. And that's why I said maybe it's better for her to put a timetable to step down. And I still think now that her authority has been lost slightly because of that election result. But also there's been changes in personnel in number 10, and a different way of interacting with the party. But, you know, you look at the appointment of Sajid Javid, for example. You know, Sajid is not a natural ideological ally of Theresa May. But she can't choose one of her natural allies for that big position, which is interesting and shows actually that she does have to think about the different factions in the party much more than just driving through her agenda. So her authority, unfortunately, has been drained and it isn't quite as strong as what it was last year.
So some things have changed in the last 12 months. Just one last quick question. When do we think the next general election is going to be? I've obviously have a personal interest in the answer to this. Gavi, please tell me we can hold out till 2022. What do you think?
I'm very much hoping for that. Having had an election a year for about the last, feels like 4 years, I've got literally no more childcare favours to ask. I'm saying, you know, put it about 2035 there.
I'm with you, sister.
I think things can, the lesson we learned from the coalition government, which everyone was predicting was going to collapse in within the next 6 months for the entirety of its duration, is that things can stagger on for loads longer than you think. I think this parliament might run a bit longer than people have been expecting.
Ryan, do you think that's right? Can we see it out, but not with Theresa May in charge the next general election, you think?
Yeah, I think it'll go through till 2022. I mean, the Tory party and the DUP have no desire, I think, to have an election and face Corbyn. And as a result of that, I think they'll stick out with Theresa in power or not in power, in charge, right and through.
In Downing Street, at least.
Yeah.
Right. The consideration is whether it would still be, how long it can still be Corbyn for, I suppose. The longer you push the election out, the more likely it is, might be another
Yes,
Labour
that's
leader.
A very good question. That's a very good question. Jill, you've seen a few governments come and go. Has this one got a while to run yet?
I think you're absolutely right. The minority governments can go on much longer than you think. Actually, they're sort of potentially much more stable than they appear on the surface. I think a really interesting question is, who on earth would really seriously want to be Prime Minister now? And I think that's possibly one of the things in Theresa May's favour. Much better if you're a sort of ambitious politician who wants to do really interesting things. You're sitting there, whether you're a sort of Michael Gove or Ruth Davidson or Sajid Javid or whatever, and say, well, let the Prime Minister do Brexit. And then actually, once we've sort of got over that, whatever that is, which I think is a really interesting question, the really interesting chance to set the agenda is to look forward. And I think one of the things that probably has emerged is that they will all be sort of battling to be the leader who can define the Tories for the 2020s rather than for the 2010s, which will be a decade dominated by Brexit.
There's some wise advice to all those challenges who are already jockeying for position. Bide your time. Thanks very much to my panel, Jill Rutter, Ryan Shorthouse and Gabby Hinsliff. Now, it's been a tough week for Transport Secretary Chris Grayling after the introduction of a new rail timetable 2.5 weeks ago led to thousands of cancellations and delays on Go Via Thames Link Railway and Northern Rail services. I'm joined on the line by Helen Pidd, the North of England editor of The Guardian. Helen, what kind of situation have travellers been facing in your part of the world in the last couple of weeks or so?
Complete despair in many cases. The provision, rail provision in the north of England has been pretty appalling for as long as I can remember, certainly the 5 years I've been up here in Manchester. But the chaos really started on the 20th of May when Northern Rail, one of the main train operators up here, introduced some new timetables. And to put it bluntly, they just weren't ready. They didn't have enough drivers who were trained on the new routes, the new timetables, and they were just cancelling trains left, right and centre. There were people left on platforms waiting for a train and suddenly it would disappear from the screens. There were replacement buses, often they didn't turn up, and things got so bad last week that the company sort of put their hands up and said, we can't cope, we're going to actually cancel 165 services, and that included closing down a whole rail line in the Lake District. And as you can imagine, people were not at all happy about it.
Who's to blame, Helen? Chris Grayling had a really tough time in the House of Commons earlier this week with MPs wanting to point the finger at him. Who are the passengers blaming?
The passengers are probably blaming the rail companies more than anybody else. And unfortunately, it's often been the drivers and the train staff who have borne the brunt of people's anger. Northern Rail themselves blame Network Rail because there have been a series of long-running electrification programmes which are wildly delayed. And to be fair to Northern Rail, there's not a huge amount they can do about those things. But also there's anger at the government. We were promised a northern powerhouse by George Osborne a few years ago. And, you know, can you have a powerhouse if you can't even get the trains to run on time? It just doesn't sit very well with many people.
And is part of the problem that the government's very good at and very keen on these kind of great big prestige projects like HS2, HS3, and not so good at thinking about, you know, how people get between A and B, you know, one town and the next?
Yeah, I think that's true. There's not much glamour in working out how to get somebody from Wigan Wallgate to Warrington Bank Quay. But ministers, you know, they love to put on their hard hats and go to the breaking ground ceremony.
George Osborne certainly did, yeah.
Yes, exactly. That was one of his favourite things to do. I mean, Philip Hammond, we very rarely see him in the north of England. He's so preoccupied with Brexit that I don't think he's got time to think about the Northern powerhouse, even if he cared about it at all. And I doubt he does, really. We see no evidence of it.
And is there a hope that this might just start to make people think a bit more clearly about transport infrastructure in the north more generally? As you say, it's a long-running problem. It's not just this last couple of weeks.
It does feel as if it has been a bit of a watershed moment. I think that Theresa May, particularly earlier this week, when all of the main newspapers in the north of England all clubbed together and did a front page telling her, get a grip, kind of, or else. The language that we've seen coming out of Number 10 and from Chris Grayling in the House of Commons this week does demonstrate that they are taking it seriously. But I must admit, I did laugh when the day that Chris Grayling was talking about this in the House of Commons, he was also announcing a third runway for Heathrow. So yet more billions for London, while the rest of us sort of chunter around on very old trains, which may or may not arrive.
Helen Pidd, thanks very much. Well, that's all we have time for now. My thanks to Jill Rutter, Ryan Shorthouse, Gabby Hinsliff, Jess Elgott and Helen Pidd. Follow all our political coverage at theguardian.com/politics. The producer was Stuart Silver. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.